there and welcome to Full Chat with me, David Prutton.
And me, Ewan Thomas, bringing you a brand new Bikers podcast celebrating all things we love about being on two wheels.
Well, Full Chat is powered by Bikeshaw, and as the UK's largest independent motorcycle insurance broker, Bikeshaw will tailor a quote to your needs, save you money on your annual bike, scooter or moped insurance, and much, much more.
So please press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from so you never miss an episode. And even better, you can catch us on YouTube and see two things. Firstly, how handsome Prutz is, and secondly, how much he looks like Ryland.
And also, we've got a dog there on the introduction as well, which is great. Just to reference to everybody listening to this, this is the maiden voyage for myself and Ewan on Full Chat. We've got a wonderful guest who we'll introduce in just a minute. The dog's done a very good job of doing that. But before we do that, Ewan, let's just describe what this is and what it's all about.
Well, it's pretty simple, really. We go back way back from when you used to play at the mighty Southampton. We both love motorbikes, so we're going to bring a podcast chatting to like-minded people, dogs included, or cats, or birds, whoever goes on the back of your bike, and bringing you everything for the love of motorbikes.
Well, we do indeed, and it seemed only right that we should join forces, set up our own potentially award-winning podcast series, and invite along some notable names to ride pillion with us and share their respective passions for all that's great about life on two wheels.
Right, so without further ado, I'd like to introduce our first guest, first gear, first show, and we're bringing you an absolute belter, one of the finest chefs this country has ever produced, learning his craft among some of the most amazing restaurants and chefs around the world. He's got a growing empire in Cornwall and beyond, so please welcome the wonderful Mr. Paul Ainsworth. Hello, Paul.
Hi, Ewan. Hi, David. Well, thank you for the introduction and apologies about Freddie.
That's so who's Freddie then? What's Freddie?
Freddie is a carver poo, and he's amazing, but he's also a git. just love him to bits.
I once had a dog called Freddie, and probably the opposite to your Freddie, he was a Labrador, and he was the most well-behaved dog there is. I've had French Bulldogs, I've had all sorts, and dogs are wonderful, but maybe not the best when you're trying to do a podcast, but he's welcome.
No, he is, and to make it worse, he's actually been put in the hallway. You know, Fred, you just need to be in here for a little bit, but if he can escape, he will.
Well, listen, I'm going to, without throwing Prutz under the bus, I wanted to start today, Paul, by showing you something, because I reckon, Prutz, every time we get a fantastic guest like Paul, we're going to find out what we've got in common, but we should scout our homes and see what we've got that could pay homage and respect to them. Oh, what is this I've got here, Prutz? Oh, that? Oh, Celebrity MasterChef Christmas
My
special.
Word.
Oh, hang on a minute. Is that a runner-up? No, I find that's the winner, that is, Prutz.
You, so,
you are talking to two amazing chefs.
I mean, love it.
If I'd have thought that was the common ground between you two, I'd have been guessing that for a very, very long time.
Yeah, you would have been. Yeah, no, listen, I love cooking, but I tell you what, I don't know how you do it in terms of the stress of being a professional chef. Because when I did the regular MasterChef series, I didn't cook for 6 months after that. It literally put me off cooking. It was so, so tough. Are you a bit of a chef, Prutz?
I'm along the lines of throwing everything in the cupboard into the same place and seeing what it feels like, tastes like. I mean, it will be over-seasoned to the max. But so, I mean, that comes from the point of view of growing up. I can gladly say I wasn't from a household full of fine diners, be that what it may, but I've always enjoyed good food and good cooking and what it does to be able to spend time with people. But if we take your journey so far, Paul, and where you are now, where you find yourself down in Cornwall, and the numerous restaurants and places that you've been able to put your name to, where does it all begin for you? Is it a pure love of food?
Absolutely. It's exactly that. I mean, I was very lucky enough to grow up in a brilliant, I suppose, like, you know, at the time I didn't realise, but the family business was a guest house. Mm-hmm. And my mum and dad built this, you know, my dad travelled abroad, you know, saved up enough money and always wanted to kind of own his own business. And I was born into hospitality. So it started out as a 5-bedroom B&B. They expanded it to 10 bedrooms. You know, in the 80s, it was quite, you know, they put sort of, remember like cable, like there was cable in all the rooms. Yeah. They built like an outdoor swimming pool in the garden, you know. So sort of, and it was 7 days a week. You know, Monday to Friday was contractors. Weekends were families because, you know, Southampton sort of had that like Tudor history. So you get quite a lot of visitors coming to Southampton. And of course, with the cruise ships and stuff, people
were you put to work out the doors, Paul, as well then, given it was your guest house?
Yeah, I mean, ferocious work ethic from my dad. I mean, you know, again, I look back on that now and I'm so thankful for that. But that work ethic, really early. By the time I was, you know, by the time I was sort of 12 years old, I was, you know, I had numerous paper rounds. I then was, you know, doing the inserts in the sort of the tabloids at 4 a.m. I then got a job as doing a fruit and veg store on the corner. Then I fancied myself as a bit of an entrepreneur with a thing called Betterware. So basically I delivered you this catalogue and then I would come back and you might find yourself thinking that you need some plastic goods that you don't really need, but oh, that's a great way to store onions or put my shower gels in the bathroom. And then I would deliver it to you. So I had loads of jobs on the go. I sort of really understood that if I wanted those new trainers or I wanted this, then I had to earn it. And that, I think that really set me in good stead for the industry I've gone into. It's a bit different. It's a bit different, I suppose, because a lot of chefs tend to have more of a culinary like romance. Mm-hmm. You know, their grandma this, or they would, you know, go strawberry picking or do this. Whereas mine, generational. Whereas I suppose from the culinary aspect is, you know, it was very much like you, David. I did not grow up with fine dining. If the old man took us out for a treat, it was to a beef eater once in a while, and it was called Around the World down on the quay, and that was like a real family treat. There was no fine dining, but they were cooking for the guests every night, and my mum's from the Seychelles, so I sort of saw my mum cook at the weekends. And because my dad worked abroad, he taught himself to cook. But then when you get to about sort of 10 years old, you start going around mates' houses, you realise dads don't do any of the cooking, didn't have a clue about cooking. Mums did all the cooking, but I had this dad that cooked. So yeah, it was, I sort of grew up on really good sort of British kind of staple dishes, you know, meat and potato pie, shepherd's pies, roast dinners, you know. I've just been like doing the finishing touches to the book, and we've put a recipe in there for like a steamed suet pudding. And it actually is inspired. I'm sure you both will remember, but the old man would sometimes buy those Fray Bentos.
Oh, yeah.
You know, those, you know, those
I used to live on them.
Those tinned.
10% meat,
yeah. Yeah, 10%. Yeah, if that, those sort of like steamed puddings and stuff. But
they came out better than they went in. They were like a sloppy, slimy mess. When I first moved to Southampton to train, I couldn't cook, and that was what I'd eat on. What I was going to say, do you think a combination then of your parents' work ethic and the fact that you've worked alongside, you know, Marcus Waring, Gordon Ramsay, you know, learning your craft, that sounds like the perfect combination to me, because as we all know, you guys have got to work so hard in the chefing, you know, in the catering industry. It's tough.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think my sort of big break, I worked in the New Forest. I was in Southampton. Well, first of all, Southampton High Street. I'm really lucky in that I've only worked for a handful of chefs, but all of them have been ass kickers. All of them have been disciplinarians, and have even German Pete at the Star Hotel. It was a 2-star hotel on Southampton High Street next to the Dolphin. And the food was what it was. We were doing toasted sandwiches, all of those sorts of things. But he was disciplined. And then he said, look, you need to go somewhere else. And I went to the New Forest. And then I was doing college as well at the same time. And then my break for London came from a college lecturer who was godfather to the late, great Gary Rhodes, his children. That was my sort of leg into London. Gary, again, was amazing to work for. That was sort of where I met, you know, my mates in London, and it was amazing. You know, it's that time of your life where you're working so hard, but then you're like out having the best time, and it's just a brilliant time. But I think when it went absolute next level was Gordon Ramsay. Mm-hmm. I was working sort of 17, 18 hour days, but then going to work those hours and a bit more for Gordon was, Gary was amazing. We won a Michelin star, but then to go and work for Gordon, which at the time was 2 Michelin stars, and Gordon wasn't known like he is now. Gordon was, you knew him if you were a chef. Mm-hmm. And to go and work in that kitchen, it almost felt like, you know, Gary Rhodes was an amazing standard, but like going in, if you compare it to like military, like going to like Gordon Ramsay was like special selection. It was like, it was phenomenal. And still to this day, you know, a lot of it a blur. I mean, the hours, the mentality, the mindset, the discipline. I mean, it was not for the faint-hearted.
And is that expected then, Paul? There's no, because having a footballing background and coming across managers that have a certain way of approaching discipline, motivation, and standards, you either get on board or you don't. You either do it or you don't. There was never a middle ground. It seems like with what you're talking about, the hours that you're working, the expectations on you being put on the man that's setting the standards as well. These men don't seem to me like they'd say, do this, do that, and then go and sit on the backside for 20 minutes while you do it. They're in there doing exactly the same thing, showing you how to do it.
Yeah, exactly that, David. And it was never personal.
Yeah.
You know, it was never done with malice. Yeah, it was hard. It was extremely hard, but you knew it was character building. Cool. Was there times where I wanted to throw it all in? Was there times where, you know, you cry yourself to sleep, where you just were feeling that you weren't good enough, that you weren't going to make it? All of those things, absolutely. But I think, again, going back to my childhood, you know, there was nothing, you know, there's so many analogies now, isn't there? There's so many sort of, you know, quotes and stuff like that. But if you were to break it down for me, it was, I even rang my mum and dad and said, look, I know you think it's the be all and end all and I'm working for this celebrity chef called Gary Rhodes, but there's this guy called Gordon Ramsay and he has like, you know, a fearsome reputation and there's a good chance I could get sacked, but they'll have to drag me out kicking and screaming. Like, I will not give up. Wow. And that was just... It's not necessarily talent or skill. It was just a mindset of, which I think had definitely been instilled, certainly from my dad, of just, you know, stick at it. And I think the big word is commitment.
Yeah. Right. Tell us when the book's out, because we've got to get to talking about bites, because we've talked football, athletics and food so far, which great basis to cover, but it's a motorbiking podcast. When's the book out? What's it called?
It's called For the Love of Food and it is out on the 4th of July, but you can pre-order it now. Now, links are on our website, Instagram. You'll find it on Amazon. Yeah, it's 4th of July, For the Love of Food. Pre-order now.
Right, let's get on some motorbikes.
Yeah, let's do it.
Come on then. You've told us where the culinary journey starts and obviously very much slap bang in the middle of that journey. Where does the motorbiking journey start?
My dad. So my dad, in all of his youth, massive biker, rocker. So I grew up in the family, always there was British bikes in the house. Went to all the shows, you know, and I loved it, from all the steam rallies, everything, to bike shows. And then when I was 10 years old, my first ever motorbike was an Italjet. And he basically... This wasn't so much trials, but the idea was to get me into trials because I loved watching Super Champs, which was more kind of bike racing, go-karts, buggies, and then another program called Kickstart. Yeah. And Kickstart was just, for me, I absolutely loved it. I just was, you know, I just could not wait for it to, you know, to come on and watch. So we started off with an Italjet, and then we sold the Italjet, and then I got my first trials bike, which was a Yamaha TY80.
Nice.
And we used to go to, I joined a club, Bishop's Waltham Trials Club, so you could either join the display team, which just wasn't for me.
Is that all the kind of triangles and all that type of stuff?
That's the one, Dave, yeah. And also as well, I've always been a bit of a big lad, so like... If I was ever going to be in that display team, I probably would be riding the bike. I might not necessarily be at the top of the pyramid.
Right? 20 people hanging off you. Yeah.
What I love about that, what you've said already, it just took me back. Two things you've said, like your dad got you into it the same as me, and then junior kickstart. I think I can even remember it. Honestly, I think it's interesting because... You know, I thought later in my life, my dad would tell me off for having fast motorbikes and that. But I've got to rewind my life story as well, the same as you. It's my dad who got me into bikes as well. And I just think there's something great a bonding between a father and a son, that you've got a mutual love for something that, yes, if it's in the wrong hands, it can be dangerous, but also it's a great, not just a way of transport, a mode of getting from A to B. You make friends through doing it. You said you can join different clubs, and yeah, it's really interesting, you know, to think of you back in the day on your motorbike watching Junior Kickstart. I love it.
Yeah, and do you know what? It's exactly that, Hugh, because if I think back, it was always a routine. Every Saturday, you know, I'd finish school for the week. We'd pack up the car, escort estate, trailer on the back. You know, even it's funny as well. You know, like how you have like triggers. I always remember as well. It was the one time like I was allowed like a can of Coke. Like we'd stop at a garage and get like a can of Coke, and we'd go to this land which was in Bishop's Waltham. And I think at first, a lot of the other dads would be like, I'm not sure your son's down with this trials. You know, it was all about like balancing and that, whereas I'd be ripping around the woods. I'd be sort of trying to get the jumps and all of that. After a while, I started to settle into it. I entered a couple of competitions and that was it. But like a lot of kids, I loved it. But then I was like, do you know what, Dad, I wouldn't mind getting a go-kart. And he was quite, as you can probably tell, quite strict from, you know, no, we're not going go-karting. It's this or nothing. So yeah, that's where my love of bike started.
He went, no, not four wheels. We're keeping you on two, which sounds really kind of arse about face, doesn't it? Not that go-kart rubbish. We're going to keep you on this, which is fundamentally more dangerous and got a lot more jeopardy in it. So that's you as an adolescent. When it comes to actually being legally allowed to get on the road with your bike, can you remember the day you test?
Oh, absolutely. Literally my birthday. I've been practicing. I was itching. Me and my best mate Vince, we already had the bikes before I was legal. Yeah. So CBT, and it was a Honda MT5.
Yeah.
So they were road legal, but they looked kind of motocross sort of style. It was that feeling, and also as well, So our childhood, at that point of our childhood, we played a lot of like roller hockey and ice hockey and stuff like that. So you were still, it was road legal, but it was still, you were still kids, you know, like I'd have two mates on their roller boots hanging onto the back of the bike, and we'd be just flat out like this. And you look back at these things, and it was like this real steep hill, Atherstone Hill, and we would go down it flat out, trying it like that. And you, bearing in mind, I've got a mate on the back who's on inline blades.
With no protection whatsoever.
With no protection whatsoever. But yeah, just brilliant times, because all of a sudden now you could start to, and obviously it was illegal, you couldn't take a pillion, but at night you would. And you'd hit all the back streets so not going on any main roads to get home so that the police wouldn't see you and stuff. But yeah, the minute I was allowed and I'd got my CBT, I was riding on my 16th birthday.
Look, I've got to just put this into perspective for people who don't know Southampton. Atherstone Hill, I've tried running up it a few times. I'm sure your motorbike went down it a lot quicker than it went up it, because that is the steepest, most horrible hill in Southampton. It really is. But just rewind a little bit. When you pass your test, because I can remember it like yesterday, when you hear those words, well, I'm pleased to tell you have passed. What does that feel like in terms of, I know what it feels like. Explain the joy you were feeling when you heard those words, that the old plates can come off. You passed your test, you're on the roads. What did it feel like?
Freedom. The absolute... And oddly, I've had it with a bicycle, with a motorbike that time, and a car. But I don't know, there's something really sort of liberating about being... Especially when you're a kid and everything seems gigantic, doesn't it? Compared to like when you sort of revisit it. But I just remember this feeling in my stomach of not being with the instructor and being on the road, the road, like on my own. That's the thing for me. That's the most vivid memory. Like, you know, in fact, the bike test was an absolute doddle, because I've been riding bikes now for, you know, the best part of 7 years. The bit that I found the hardest was the theory test, because the theory had just come in for me. I didn't help myself, because, you know, I mean, sometimes I'd go, I mean, it took me about three times, and I think two of those theory tests, I'd just gone straight from a party, straight to the theory test.
I was lucky. You had theory as well. So I didn't have that. Back in my day, you just got asked a couple of really routine questions. Yeah, that will do. So mine was literally 50cc, then onto a 125, pass my test, thanks very much, go and get an R1 or whatever you want. It was different then, but really interesting. You mentioned one word there when I said to you, what was it like, you know, when you passed? Freedom. And I think we'll all agree, the beauty of being on two wheels is you can put your crash helmet on, you put your visor down, and especially in a world where you're living, like you said earlier, you're responsible for a lot of members of staff. It's a highly strung career that you choose to go down. It's tough. What's that feeling like then when you shut the visor, you've had a really stressful day in the kitchen? What's it like when you can just get out of there and do your own thing?
Yeah, I think then there was a bike in between, which we can go back to, but that for me was the best bike ever for me that I had was an R6. Hmm. So saved up. By now I'm working for Gordon, and that is, as I've told you, that is an environment that demanded so much. And, you know, I went on some incredible trips on that bike, you know, like fast forwarding a little bit, but I never knew I was going to move to Cornwall. But the year before I moved to Cornwall, I rode the R6 from London to Cornwall in every type of weather condition you could imagine. And I'd obviously had a lot of bike experience, but I'd never ridden something as powerful, something, you know. And again, you're not going on a Honda Goldwing. Do you know what I mean? Like sat upright, all nice and comfy. You are in like race position, and it took me 9.5 hours to get from London to Padstow.
Backpack on, Paul. And, I mean, is that all you had on with you? There's no big panniers. There's no top box. There's nothing. No, the Grand Touring stuff.
Nothing. And I was in a hand-me-down Hein Gerrick Gore-Tex two-piece, which even though it was Gore-Tex, I mean, I don't think I'd even got out of London, and I was soaked to the bone. And what I was doing was I was stopping in services. I had, because that's the ones I wanted. It was all, I had these like really smart Alpine Star boots. And I had to stop in services and put shopping bags over my feet because my feet were sopping like this. It was just, but it was phenomenal. And I loved it. And I'd done some big rides on that bike. But that for me, of all the bikes I've had, that was the one where it felt like, right, you're riding something proper. Yeah. And it was just, I think everything that everyone wants out of biking, for me, it was that on the R6.
That word that Ewan's talked about, which is the freedom one, which is when you do pass your test. And I know it's structurally very different now. I've got neighbours and friends that have gone through it as not older men, but as proper adults. And you kind of hear what it is to get to that full licensed position. But with a bike, you can go from something that you can poodle around. I remember taking a 125 up to the lakes thinking I was easy ride, and looking behind me, there's 40 cars all going, will this geezer get above 35 miles an hour going up this hill? And you're sort of thinking, like, feeling like Dennis Hopper. And then you pass your test, and then they just say, well, you can go and ride anything now. And you think, what, anything? Yeah, if you want to go and get a Rocket 3 from Triumph, which is, what, 2.5 litres, you can go get one of that. I mean, your insurance might break the bank. But to go from that to just that spectrum just opens up, doesn't it? And like you say, if you go along those lines and getting on that first bike or the first proper big bike, and it just makes you think, doesn't it, what you accept now as a biker. I love my heated grips. I love my heated top. I love my proper wet stuff. I love not having to go out when it's raining. But early doors, you just go, no, it'll be fine. And then you think back and you just think, so if I rode from here to Cornwall and I was going to stop at every service station and wring my boots out, I mean, the older gentleman in you goes, not sure I'd do that, to be brutally honest.
No.
You just trick yourself into it, don't you?
You're spot on. And do you know what? Recently, even, you know, I've been thinking about, you know, our conversation and what we were going to talk about today. But even before I knew I was coming on here, there are times I think, I'm not sure how I did that. And I definitely couldn't do that now. And also as well, you know, like no GPS, you know, I don't know Cornwall, you know, I'm coming down here, you know, for a week. I just wanted to go somewhere. I wanted to ride somewhere. And all, like you say, all of those, you know, all of those things that you take into account, and believe it or not, I came to Padstow. And the following day, I was walking around Padstow like a tourist, and I remember going to the spa shop, which is next door but one to number six.
No.
And I just remember, yeah, literally remember stood outside number six, and it was a for sale sign up. So basically, if someone had tapped me on the shoulder in 2004, which is when I was there,
yeah,
and that was, I rode down in the May, and I moved down to Cornwall to live in 2005 in the November.
Is there any connection, just thinking out loud, between the fact you went on an R6 and the restaurant's called Sit Number Six? Is it, you like the number six?
Yeah, love the number six. And it was called Number Six Restaurant and Rooms. But I had, like everybody else, my memories of Cornwall was actually Vince, who I mentioned earlier. His mum and dad would bring us down every summer, and we'd go further down to a place called Mullion and stay in a static caravan. I was living in London. I wasn't sure what my next move was going to be, but I had no idea I was going to be living in Cornwall a year later.
I'm just imagining now, like, I'm looking outside here in Southampton, the rain is tipping down, and as you know, the roads are busy now. But Cornwall, to me, I associate that with, like, nice country lanes, the beautiful sunshine. I'm assuming you do still get out on your bike, and it must be lovely where you live to go for rides.
Yeah, it is beautiful. I mean, there is so much, as you say, of that, that, you know, that good ride. I think where I am, Hewin, I would definitely say sort of Padstow to Bude. Is an absolutely brilliant road when you get to Bude, but it's breathtaking. And that, I think of all the places I went on the R6, that trip to Cornwall, because the following day I got to the B&B, and then the next morning when I woke up, the weather was beautiful. So I'd ridden down in every type of weather you could, hailstones, everything. And you know when it's a bit sketchy when you're going past a lorry who's in the middle lane and you feel the tyres get caught in the indentations of the tarmac.
Yeah.
Anyway, I get to call. Anyway, following day it was absolutely beautiful, and I rode from Padstow to Newquay on the coast road, and that is phenomenal. And then, which you'll both appreciate this, I stopped at a farm called Strawberry Fields, which is on the way to Newquay. And I was just having like a scone and a cup of tea doing an old tourist thing. And then a bloke came out. He said, "Oh, nice bike." He said, I'm well into bikes. And then he literally, you're not bikers alike. He took me to, he had a garage on the farm, and he had an R1, he had a Fireblade.
No way.
Just had this whole big collection of bikes. And I ended up spending about 2 hours there just with this guy. Because you just have this shared interest, don't you?
Yeah.
You know, like. And I was explaining to my daughter the other day, we were just chatting away about, you know, like how bikers nod to each other.
Yeah.
And I was trying to tell her that, but a biker on a bike will not nod to a moped.
Correct.
You'll do the nod to sort of, even if it's a totally different bike, right? Yeah. But if it's a motorbike. But you will not nod to a moped.
Yeah. Look, they've not got their badge of honour yet. The moped riders do not have the badge of honour to get the respect of it, the effort it takes after nine and a half hours on an R6 to nod.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, no, I'm not remotely bothered about what you're on. If it's anything smaller than this, not remotely bothered about it.
No.
The one thing, I think, north, south, wherever you're from, the love of bikes draws people together, doesn't it? Like you said earlier, Paul, you know, you met that guy down in Cornwall, and he showed you his collection of bikes. I think there's kind of like an appreciation between bikers that, you know, what you've probably all been through. Like you said, you've done those tough journeys through the wind and the rain. But the love of bikes, whatever your background, you might be totally different personalities, but the fact that you've got a bike, there's a brotherhood, isn't there? There's a companionship. There's something that brings people together. And it's really nice.
Yeah, I mean, it's everywhere. Like you say, when I've been on the ferry with the bike, you know, you go upstairs and all of a sudden find yourself with the bike.
Love it being on a ferry on a bike.
Being on a ferry, on a bike, the community. Brilliant. You know, like every year my dad would go, he's gone to the TT a couple of times, but he would go to the Manx, because then obviously a lot of the British stuff, the old stuff. Mm. And I would just love listening to him talking to me about the stories. And again, you know, that sort of brotherhood, you know, like the Isle of Man and everything that encompasses. And I just, and it's funny as well, you know, I've been, you know, very lucky to, you know, to go to, you know, like Formula One, and I've, you know, been, you know, had some great trips where, especially through my job, where you can have paddock pass and all of that. And this is just, you know, personal, you know, opinion. That's been brilliant. But the best motorsport I've ever seen was going to British Superbikes at Brands Hatch. And I rode the bike there with me, the guy I told you give me the hand me down Hein Gerrig suit. He was on a Honda 600, and it was just the best weekend. And not just for the racing, but also as well, we were kind of right on that, you know, by Druids. And like I just still vividly to this day, just seeing like these guys led on the tank, and like the back end was just completely out of control. Like just the sheer athleticism to keep that thing straight going through like what they did. There's nothing like it. I've been to Formula One quite a few times and stuff, but the adrenaline and but also, as you're saying, the camaraderie and the community of bikes, and just, it was just fantastic. I just remember parking as well, and just as far as the eye could see, like pretty much, it felt like everybody had come to watch the race on their bike. Obviously there was a car parked for cars, but you've just never seen bikes.
That collective together, Paul, is amazing, isn't it? It does feel like an army when you all get off, taking the helmets off. Yeah.
Goose pimples telling you about it. It's some of my greatest moments and times and conversations, and the people I've met, you know, bikers. It's such an amazing community.
It's a different world, I think. I'm just thinking of an example where if you break down in a car and you're stuck on the A34, I think the majority of people just drive past and think, oh, he'll be all right. But if you break down on a bike, or you stopped, other bikers will come and help you. They will. Yeah. They might not be the most mechanically gifted, but they'll do what they can to help you, because it's almost like being part of a team. It really is something special, and you talked about, you know, being at the British Superbikes there, and, you know, anything, MotoGP, World Superbikes, it's the smell, it's the noise, it's the atmosphere. It's everything about owning a bike, which is so different from owning a car. I mean, apart from the weather, Paul, if you had your dream garage, right, you open up, you've got your cars in there, bikes in there. Why would you choose a bike over a car? Tell us quickly. I think I know the answer, but what makes being on a bike so much more unique and special than in a car?
Do you know what? Everything we've spoken about so far, the people first, that's a big one. The sense of freedom, I think, as well, of all the bikes I've had, the R6, not for one second am I some gifted rider, or, you know, and don't get me wrong, there was times where I thought, God, what, did I get my knee quite close there? Did I? I used to look at the tire lines on the back wheel and all of that, and I'm completely not. But that bike felt
mine just
like
squared off, Paul, if that makes you feel any better. Mine just squared off.
But that bike to me made me feel like I was really sort of accomplished. It made me feel like I was a good rider. And it made, I don't know what it was about that bike, but it felt like I could just chuck it into the corner. It felt like, I know this is, and you'll understand, but if you're listening to this and you're not like sort of into bikes, but I felt at one with that bike. Yeah. I felt that bike was almost like it was molded to me. And I just knew the limits of what I could do. I mean, the bike far outweighed, you know, me, you know, but in terms of what I could do, my skill set, that feeling was just incredible. And like you say, those trips, the Brands Hatch or the ferries, or, you know, doing big, you know, big bike rides. I did a big ride in Denmark, and all of those times are just, you just, for me, especially as well, if you kind of go somewhere, you know, a brilliant, you know, lads holiday in Mallorca, me, Vince again, and another lad called Cookie. Me and Vince have obviously got the CBT. And obviously it's Mallorca. They don't care. There's like, you literally turn up in a pair of Bermuda shorts with no top on. And here you go. Here's a bike. Here's a sort of 250 crosser. Go and have a good time. But Cookie was on a moped, so we just ripped him the whole time. But the memories that sort of, we went all around the island, and also as well back home could only go to 125. Here we're on like a 250, and it's like real back high mud guard, and we're just kind of messing around and having the best time. Stopped off somewhere, went swimming in the sea, got back to the bike, realized that the keys were in my pocket, so the keys are on the seabed in another country. So we were like hours searching the seabed, but guess what? We found them.
Nice.
No way.
We found the keys.
I've got to ask you, every time you talk about this beloved R6, your face lights up. Do you still own it? Please tell me you've still got this bike.
Long story short, it actually got stolen from a garage that I were basically servicing it, and I was in between houses, so they said, look, yeah, we'll it's not a problem, it's not in the way. They serviced it, and then I was kind of storing it there for a bit, and got stolen.
Inside job, if you ask me that one.
Yeah. Inside job.
That was like, right. No, sorry. I don't want to get sued. Yeah.
Just to swing this back onto a wonderfully positive note at the end, conscious of time, Paul. It's been so nice of you. Very kind of you to join myself and you to get us up and running.
Absolute pleasure.
You've discussed some really wonderful times, really emotive as well. They really make you think and feel, and we can picture what you're talking about, but... With the podcast, final question of each episode is going to be one where we can create that idyllic mental image of riding off into the sunset. We all know music, bikes, they've always gone together. We're all very much on the same page as that. So we need to finish off by asking you what your fantasy ride is. So where you're going, what you're on, and what's the soundtrack to it?
Oh, great question. Okay, I think I would love to be somewhere like California. I think some of the routes there, and just really kind of, you know, get the hammer down. Mm-hmm. And I'm gonna go with. Have you seen those guys that do the custom bikes? It's Thornton Motorcycles.
Thornton 100, lovely. Beautiful motorcycle.
Supercharge it.
So because of that style of riding, something like that bobber style, where you're just kind of feeling Terminator 2 vibes. So I'm gonna go with Guns N' Roses. I'm gonna go with Guns N' Roses. You Could Be Mine.
Amazing.
I love it.
I'm there. We're there, aren't you?
I'm liking you very much. Next time you're in Southampton, you need to look me up, because, you know, forget going for a motorbike ride. We'll go for a cheeky pie and a pint.
I'd love that, mate. I absolutely love it.
I'll tell you what, Prax, that's a good little routine there. Out in California, Guns N' Roses, bobber bike, T-shirt, love it.
T-shirt. Open face.
Yeah, open face. Okay. So, you're absolutely right. It's sort of like a nice kind of fitted kind of T-shirt, tanned brown gloves.
Yeah.
Just kind of nice and short, open face. And jeans, boots, that's it.
Love it.
This sounds like we need to take this pod stateside, and this could be a little trip with the three of us. I'm in on that one.
So that's
my fantasy ride, lads.
That's absolutely amazing. I tell you what, this is flown by. That's about it for this week's full chat, powered by Bikeshaw, the UK's largest independent motorcycle insurance broker. Bikeshaw will tailor a quote to exactly what you need, help save money on your annual bike, scooter or moped insurance, and much more.
A huge thank you to our very special guest. I tell you, I've learned a lot about him today, and he's an absolute legend. I love him already. Paul Ainsworth, thank you, Paul, for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Genuinely, that was brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. So thank you.
You're a star, Paul. Don't forget to follow us on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from. And of course, you can see us on YouTube if you so desire.
And I'm sad to say that is it for the end of our episode today. But thank you so much for listening, and we will see you next time. Goodbye.